This Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and here in the studio once again for one of our occasional visits is Northwest Indiana activist Ruth Needleman. Ruth, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. I love coming.
Number of things to bring up, and one thing in particular that residents in Gary and Merivale certainly should make note of. There's a public forum coming up this evening talking about, the forum flyer talks about the future of Methodist hospitals. And we know that Methodist hospitals have entered into a letter to explore what is being called a merger, although the hospitals are not quite going that far. But they are talking about the opportunity for the Methodist hospitals in Gary and in Merivale to become part of the Franciscan Alliance Network that, of course, stretches not only through Northwest Indiana, but entire state of Indiana these days. And that public meeting tonight will hopefully answer a number of questions that residents probably have about this in turn. The CEO of Methodist Hospitals, Ray Grady, spent some time talking with us on this program some time back about the efforts that were being made by the boards to look into this scale of economies combination of services. And I'm sure that he'll probably have a lot to talk about this evening, I would imagine.
Well, I think there's some very important questions that people have to think about with this. First of all, Methodist has a long-standing agreement to make sure that services at Methodist Gary are full services. It's the only hospital in Gary. And that Merivale doesn't get all the investment and all the money. And it's not clear, and this is something that will come up, is Franciscan, who has eaten up almost everything in Northwest Indiana, almost every doctor I have is now part of the Franciscan network. But will they honor that commitment to the Gary Methodist Hospital as a full service, equal in all of its services to what it provides in Merivale? Another question has to do with the employees there. The employees of Methodist Hospital have been union for a very long time, and good workers are hard to get if you don't have decent pay and decent benefits. And will they honor the current contract with SEIU that represents the workers at Methodist? Will they try to lower the cost of the Gary Methodist by not bargaining in good faith with the union, not recognizing the union, or trying to short staff, which is already a big problem in hospitals across the country?
I think that the SEIU is one of those that help organize this evening's public forum.
That's right. I would definitely recommend. I will be there with my camera, and I would recommend that people go, because if you live in Gary, this is your hospital, and anything else is pretty far away. And so it's really critical that we maintain a first-rate hospital in Gary, Indiana. And it's going to be at Ivy Tech in the multipurpose room on 35th Avenue, just down the street from IUN. And so I would get there a little early so you can get a good seat and maybe even talk to some of the folks ahead of time to see what the other issues are.
As important a public forum as this is, I'm sure there will be quite a few people who will be there to ask questions. Certainly among the employees and staff and family members of those who work currently for Methodist Hospitals, as well as what kind of impact that the Franciscan Alliance folks will probably have to answer questions as well, too.
That's right. And the Northwest Federation of Interfaith Organizations has been involved for some time, because they know that unequal services is what Gary tends to get all the time. And so they're very concerned, and I know they're mobilizing also for this event.
One of the other meetings recently, as of last Friday, as a matter of fact, was another of the series of ongoing protests and complaints about how the immigration and customs enforcement people are taking their hand on folks who are being living in America illegally and in turn deporting them. And, of course, the flights for those deportees out of the Gary-Chicago International Airport. You were at the latest event that happened last week. And tell us about what happened and how the process is coming along.
Well, this is a very difficult issue. I don't think the audience is aware that Gary gets no benefit from this. The city of Gary and the Gary Airport do not get any of the funding that goes along with the deportations. McHenry County, Illinois, brings the detainees who come from the entire Chicago area and southern Wisconsin to the airport for deportation. And the airplane, which is a charter company out of Brownsville, Texas, takes the people down to Brownsville and leaves them at the border, pushing them to the other side. And we have been able to find out that none of these people are guilty of what you would call crimes, serious criminal activities. Not having documentation is a civil offense, although the current administration in Washington is trying to criminalize almost everything. And so one thing that has been high up on their priority is deporting people who have committed no crime. 40% of all the increase deportations that are going on are people who have not committed crimes other than wanting to be with their family. And so it's hard to figure out what to do. The Jet Center has a contract with the airline, the air carrier, and the air carrier has a contract with immigration. The money does not come to the city, but the black mark does come to the city. Because having people deported, and this last time, we were able to see people getting off these buses, and these are ghost buses, because they're all white with white across the windows, and they parked in front of the airplane, and you could see them going up the steps with shackles. They had to have help to get up the steps. These are not criminals. These are family members desperate to remain. Some of the people, even some of the people from Indiana, have been here 10, 20, 30 years. There's a man from Colombia who is being deported who worked as a waiter in a restaurant in Elkhart. And the people of Elkhart, a very conservative town, were up in arms that their waiter was being taken away. As soon as you put a human face, people begin to understand what's happening. And one of the other important things that's going on is the deportation of veterans. U.S. veterans who have fought for this country are being picked up, maybe for a minor drug offense, maybe because they didn't carry their papers with them, and they're being deported very quickly. And all of this is really a terrible thing to be going on in a city like Gary that was built by immigrants from Europe and refugees from the South. That's who built the steel mills, that's who built the town, built the cities, and lived here. And yet, that's who is being picked up and deported in our city. And I think you know, we talked about it last time, The city of Gary passed a welcoming ordinance saying, we don't want to see our people picked up for no reason and deported when they've committed no crime. Well, and a civil offense is not the same thing as a criminal act.
And those would be cases that should be coming up in federal court.
That's
in
right.
Hammond, no doubt, or maybe,
well,
maybe Chicago.
Well, there's a huge lack of due process, and there's special judges just for immigration. That's all they handle. And they're very unpredictable. One judge in Chicago just let somebody remain because he humanely figured it out that this person had three children and that the three children who are U.S. citizens would suffer more than the benefit to this country of deporting their father. Mm-hmm. But that's not usually the outcome. And so we do want to stop these deportations. But it's going to be difficult, and there will be a program on The Loop TV on June 8th. They're doing a documentary on the deportations at the Gary Airport. I encourage people to take a look at it and to give us a hand. We will be returning on a regular basis to at least let them know we're watching. They have three entrances to the airport. No matter where we go, they enter somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So who knows? We might be turning up at all three entrances the next time.
One of the other topics we want to bring up here that has come up, of course, before, and get an update on if there's something to talk about, or the problems with the quality of drinking water here in Northwest Indiana, in particular in the communities of East Chicago and some other communities as well, too, where we've had heavy industrial activity over the decades, and they are turned not as quite as bad off as East Chicago is, but you still have places in Gary and no doubt in Hammond and other communities as well, too.
Well, Gary, East Chicago. Michigan City has some serious problems right now with their water. Mm-hmm. And there's been a bunch of people posting recently in the Miller area saying that the water's coming out yellow. And I think what we have to understand is all of these old industrial cities have lead pipes. And lead pipes will always release lead into the water. And it's quite expensive to replace it. My neighbor replaced her lead pipes before she could sell her house, and it was $2,000-$3,000. Mm-hmm. And most people in Gary, in Michigan City, who live where the water is worse, do not have money to put in new pipes. I've gotten two letters now signed by the mayor of Gary from a private company that wants me to buy insurance on those pipes. And I can't figure out why the mayor would sign the letter, but she's into what she calls cost sharing. In other words, trying to get money out of people who have some and forgetting about the people who have none. And I think you know this, but in Flint, they're not only still drinking bottled water, but now, because they will not pay for the polluted water, they are having their water turned off completely. And so poor communities, poor industrial communities throughout the Rust Belt are suffering from contamination that is life-threatening, certainly for young children, and really will be the demise of our cities if it's not taken more seriously and if money is not invested.
We know that the state is taking some steps to help, at least for some part, the issue of making sure that drinking water in schools in areas like East Chicago are taken care of. They've made plans to be able to replace piping as well as water fountains and the like in schools that are affected. So there'll be some help coming to some people.
Of course, Carrie Bosch was already shut down. Brand new school building had to be shut down, and people were sent over to another school. And when they forced everybody out of West Calumet, they sent some people in the middle of the school year to South Chicago to projects that are dangerous. And so, yes, the state is giving some help. IDEM has said, yes, we have to do better. But the fact of the matter is, how many years has it been in Flint? 4 years now, mm-hmm. and they still don't have drinking water. And I think the people, especially in zones 2 and 3, who own their homes, they can't sell their homes because they've lost all their value due to the lack of water and the contamination in the soil. And so we really need a new deal. We need a special plan to save the Midwest from what was vast industrial pollution. And the corporations who did it have not been providing a single penny.
Northwest Indiana activist Ruth Needleman with us talking about some of the issues. And, of course, we'll have you back again soon and continue the conversation. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
It was my pleasure, and I look forward to talking again.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. One of the latest recipients of the Innovator Awards from the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana goes to Michigan City, in this case to a project in Michigan City that is entitled Art Space Lofts. And to talk about that project, one of the big key people behind it, Michigan City Controller Rich Murphy. Rich, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you very much, Chris. I'm happy to be here. Yes, Art Space has been a big deal for Michigan City. It's really been the symbol of what is a comeback story in Michigan City. For so long, mm-hmm. people that have come here have talked about the potential, but Michigan City hadn't seemed to garner the momentum. And they have done so with a catalytic project, and there's reasons why this has given us the momentum that it has with Art Space. Art Space is in a building that is 7 stories tall. It's the biggest building on Franklin Street. It was the location of our Montgomery wards when Franklin Street thrived throughout the 40s and 50s, when downtown was the place to be. But for the last three decades, it sat vacant, and much of our downtown was vacant. That was something that happened to many Rust Belt towns. So Michigan City, like a lot of other cities, is trying to find its way back downtown. And we've done so with what we believe is an innovative project called ArtSpace. We're the first ArtSpace project in the state of Indiana. And ArtSpace is the largest non-for-profit developer in the nation of artist-lived workspace.
I understand this is quite a distinctive building in its own right. Tell us about the building and how it has come back from being a vacant building now to what it is today.
The building was built in 1908. It was the marquee building. It was the biggest, tallest building on Franklin Street. Mm-hmm. It housed the Montgomery Ward's department store. It had a life as City Hall. It was a hotel. It had office space. Doctors and dentists had their offices there. So it was a building that was used by the public. And throughout generations, people used this building, and it was iconic in Michigan City. So you can imagine the impact on this city when a building that so many generations have used is now sitting vacant for decades. And that really became the opportunity for Michigan City. The building was owned by a local developer who owned the entire block, and the city had a opportunity to wrestle this building out of the hands of this developer and to look at an innovative use. This project happened during one of the biggest recessions in U.S. history.
Yeah.
So we had to be innovative about how to finance it. And so we worked with ArtSpace, and we created a financial layering system that could be feasible. And we applied for 3 years of tax credits. And on the third year, we got the good news that we were awarded $10 million of federal tax credits for this project. And that really planted the seed for the ArtSpace project to become a reality.
Now, you've given us an idea of what is in ArtSpace Lofts. Tell us about some of the specific artists that are interested or either is in the facility or have actually gone ahead and taken up space.
Yeah, it's so exciting. The concept of ArtSpace is that you have to be an artist pursuing your art form.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a peer group that that measures that standard, and there's an approval process. But it's so exciting because there's musicians, there's writers, there's sculptors and painters and poets, and it's so exciting to have all these creators and these makers in our downtown. It adds to the vibrancy and the creative energy and really makes it a special place downtown. These people have lived there with their families, and they support the local businesses, and they've really become a catalyst to cause redevelopment to happen next door, across the street. In fact, when this ArtSpace project opened, literally next door, a sushi bar opened.
Wow.
And next door to that, a California-style Mexican restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And the positive energy continues. But once that kind of Goliath was slayed, the seven-story building, it really sent a strong message to the marketplace that Michigan City is back, and that there's a special thing happening downtown, and we have a cool downtown. It's hip. It's authentic. We're not polished in Michigan City. We're not trying to be someone who we aren't. We're proud of our industrial legacy, and we're proud of our historic buildings, and at the same time, we're proud of our majestic lakefront and dunes and the natural beauty that we have here. So there's really a great thing happening. And this building, this art space, because it was used for so many decades by the previous generations, now these generations seeing this building back in action and walking down the street where, again, there's thousands of people walking down Franklin Street like they remember in the 40s and 50s, you can imagine what a powerful symbol of the comeback story this building can be. At the same time, you have the new generation of younger people who are growing up where they're seeing their downtown coming back, and they're seeing these old stories become new stories, and the artists are causing economic development to happen. And it's really an exciting thing to be part of in the city.
Now, since you are a member of the Michigan City Administration, of course, along with Mayor Ron Meir, you get to see other projects going as well, too. What else in Michigan City can be coupled along with this particular project, ArtSpace Lofts, that can help continue the economic development and growth in the downtown area in particular?
Yeah, we are concentrating on our downtown revival because that's good economic policy in the United States right now. You are judged by your downtown. So if you can create a sense of something special happening in your downtown, that causes the big picture to happen, which is bringing in investment, building our tax base, creating jobs. So, I mean, that's what this is all about, is looking to the next generation, the big picture, how we can keep kids from leaving Michigan City, how we can have people come back home because there is something to come home to, because there's job growth, because we are addressing things like our emerging commuter market to Michigan City, which is one of the biggest projects that's happening right now is the double track project in Michigan City,
right,
in Northwest Indiana. And for us, this is we just have the Governor Holcomb here to sign the bill in Michigan City's train station. It was an exciting day. But what it does for us is it's a game changer, because it basically takes a lasso around Chicago and pulls Chicago closer to us, so the job market is closer.
And that's got to be helpful, too. Of course, taking the tracks out of the middle of the street is certainly going to be a major improvement, but that should also, I would imagine, make it easier for people to move into the neighborhoods around the tracks. You'll still have access to the trains headed to Chicago and points in between, but it's going to be probably a lot easier for folks to be able, certainly, to get around that area once the tracks are relocated out of the middle of the streets there.
Yeah, what it does is it creates an area that is prime for development. Transit-oriented development will move into that area because they are walking distance from the train station, which will change the commuter trip from 1 hour and 38 minutes, which is the current train ride, to about an hour. So once that double-track project brings our commuter time down to an hour, it effectively makes us a comp as a community to places like Naperville, Illinois. So we can compete with those communities, but with more advantages, because we have a lower cost of living, we have a lower cost of doing business, and we believe we have a higher quality of life because of the waterfront lifestyle that we can offer. So again, this is a big picture. It's about, we're selling a lifestyle in Michigan City. And in Northwest Indiana, where in a sense you can have it all. You can have the small waterfront town in the cool, historic downtown, the majestic beaches. But this all happens in the backdrop of the world-class city of Chicago. And it happens in a way that is affordable, more affordable, and cost-effective. So this really becomes the new frontier for development moving east from Chicago. The winds of opportunity, we believe, are blowing east towards the dunes, and places like Michigan City and other towns in Northwest Indiana, we believe, are prime for an improvement for the next generation.
Rich Murphy is the city controller in Michigan City, and we've been talking with him in specifics about the ArtSpace Lofts, which is the symbol of a downtown Business District comeback in Michigan City. You'll have to go downtown, check it out for yourself there along Franklin Street. And this project is one that picked up an Innovator Award from the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana. And Rich, thank you very much for being with us to talk about it today. Good luck and all the other projects coming along, aside, of course, from the work that that NICTI is doing on the South Shore line and the double tracking within the city of Michigan City. And we hope to have a chance to chat with you more about some other big projects in Michigan City in the future. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Chris. Always appreciate the opportunity to talk about Michigan City, and I hope to see you on Franklin Street soon.
Our next topic we're taking up on the program today deals with, in fact, it's going to be basically an ongoing topic, obviously, about the crime spillage that comes out of Illinois across into Northwest Indiana. It's been talked about in many cases before. We know the now retired U.S. Attorney David Capp has been working very hard with his forces in the U.S. Attorney's Office and with local law enforcement to deal with the problems, especially with the gang problems that have come over from Chicago into Northwest Indiana, and the crimes that happen, many of them drug-related and violent crimes, too, that come about as a result. But this, just in general, we see this spillage that have happened from Illinois into Northwest Indiana. And we're starting up the conversation today. We're bringing in to talk about this Lake County Sheriff's Department Deputy Chief Dan Merchak. If you're not familiar with Deputy Chief Merchak, he's a lifelong Lake County resident. He's involved in law enforcement since 1985 when he started in with one of the region area police departments, and then he ended up becoming a member of the Dyer Police Force, as well as over time became, of course, a member of the Lake County Sheriff's Department back in the mid-90s, where he has, of course, been since then and worked his way up in the ranks to being the Deputy Chief of Police. He's also, by the way, too, involved, of course, in labor in the region. He's the president of FOP Lodge Local 72, Lake County Police Unit, Local 72, and he's also the head of the Northwest Indiana Federation of Labor, too, one of some of the other hats that he wears. But we've asked him to come in and talk today about the crime problem. And thank you for being with us today.
Glad to be here.
Well, first, let's look into the issues here, I guess, in general about, we mentioned before, David Capp has talked many times, and we've had his conversations on talking about the overall problem of crime that managed to work its way from Illinois into Northwest Indiana. Where do we see that this problem coming down to the more of the local level as opposed to just strictly the U.S. Attorney's Office and the federal courts?
Well, you know, everybody knows that, and if you lived here and you're part of the region, we blend right in with Illinois and Chicago and vice versa. You can go down the state line, and if you're not familiar with the area, you know, you don't know if you're in Calumet City or you can be in parts of Chicago or parts of Burnham or Lansing, and it all blends in. And, you know, we talk about this now, but really this has probably been going on for years in different, you know, formats. In different times when, you know, depending on what type of the crimes, either was bootlegging back in the days or a lot of different things that have happened along the state line. You know, a lot of the streets are the same names. So it's, you know, if you don't know your geographic area, it all looks the same. So the criminals, obviously, you know, they don't care where they're doing their activities at. It's about what they're going to do and making money and carrying out the, you know, the crimes that they're attempting to commit. So it all really blends in, and it's probably been going on much longer. I know over the years we've had a big push, especially with the increase in gang activity over the last, you know, 20, 30 years when gangs start to become a lot more prevalent in the area and developing. We've had a big push. David Capp worked really hard at it. But the local law enforcement has been working at this for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Is there a fear that, and you probably see this on the local level more than certainly on a more regional basis, that there's a fear that about some of the crimes that happen in Illinois coming over here into Northwest Indiana because there's no border, there are no gates, there's no fence between the Illinois and the Indiana state line?
No, there's not. And it's no different if you're up in the northern part of Chicago by Wisconsin or maybe some of the other cities and states that border each other. So, you know, everybody's part of the Chicago metropolitan area here. We have millions of people here. So, you know, crime doesn't know boundaries. Gang members don't know boundaries. So you did have a large spillover here. A lot of them come over here and have set up shop, either selling drugs or prostitution. You know, you have some human trafficking activity that slides over here. So there's a lot of different things that are going on over here. And the same thing can be said for people on this side have gone over there. Obviously, we've seen a big increase from people coming out of Illinois into Indiana. You know, Chicago had an idea of tearing down a lot of their housing developments. Mm-hmm. And that has caused had a large effect and spill over here too.
Is it a case now we're seeing maybe not always the same crimes, but different types of crimes? Or are we seeing cycles where we find like we mentioned before about the fact we've had the prostitution, the human trafficking issues, we have the drug issues that seem to be ongoing? Are we finding different types of crimes that making this wave across Illinois and coming into Northwest Indiana?
I don't think so. I think it's all the same crime. I think people, you know, see an opportunity where they've came over here or they've made connections over here and have expanded. You know, drugs is always one of the biggest problems that's behind most crimes. You know, either you're committing a crime because you have a drug habit and you need the money, so it causes you to do robberies or different types of things, or you're over here, you know, selling the product. To people that are here, and you know, there's opportunity to do that here. You see that now with the heroin epidemic we're having, which is across this whole country, mm-hmm. and it doesn't have anything to do with who you are or what you are. Heroin, you know, does not discriminate. People get caught on this. It's a deadly product out there right now. They're mixing it with all kinds of things out there, fentanyl and other issues, and it's 20, 30 times stronger. So you see people from Indiana going over there to buy the heroin, then they're bringing it back over here also.
A couple other things that I wanted to bring up in the chance we have to talk today is talking about the relationship that law enforcement has, and it's not just a particular police department, it's all of the police departments working together with the community to try to build a better relationship in the hopes that they can trying to maybe not stop the crime from happening, but at least catch the criminals faster and get them dealt with quicker and try and at least abate the problems.
Well, there's really two parts to it. The number one part is that we work in conjunction with our Illinois agencies and our partners in law enforcement over there. We have officers assigned to federal task force where they're working in Illinois and in Chicago, and the same thing over here with HIDTA groups and local groups that and, you know, local officers that work along the state line have established good working contacts with their, you know, fellow officers across that state line when they need something. They know a lot of the same players. But the other component is the community. You can't put a policeman on every corner. It's you can't do it. It would cost too much. And that necessarily is not going to solve the problem. You have to have the community. The community is the eyes and ears out there. They know what's going on, and it's about them getting involved and stepping up.
One of the other things I know, certainly you mentioned about the cooperation with the public in trying to deal with, I guess, creating, I'm sure they're already set down because you have to have some guideline, having proactive plans to not only combat but to reduce crime here in Northwest Indiana.
Well, absolutely. You know, one of the things that we've seen the increase, obviously, is increase in crime, and violent crime has increased over here. And the gang structure also has broken down as to how it normally used to be from years ago, because we did a really good job on going after gangs and breaking them down and attacking them. Some are much more organized than others. So just because you're a gangster disciple and you're a gangster disciple doesn't mean that, you know, we're friends, because you're from a different part of the city. And you see that, and that's one of the reasons I think you see in Chicago too, is that they did a good job of breaking down some of that. But now you have so many smaller pockets of gangs and subsections of gangs that are more violent against each other to protect a much smaller area.
That's where the problem we see almost every day, where we have all these homicides over in Chicago and incidents where it's retaliation crime, retaliation homicides too, where you've got family members, unfortunately, that have been members of gangs or have had family members who are members of gangs, and it's this turf war, as you say, that comes about. These, we know that that's a lot of, not all of them, but a lot of the crimes, a lot of these homicides in particular in Chicago have been related because of incidents like that. We're not quite seeing that over here on our side of the line, are we?
We do occasionally see some retaliations of crimes and gang members and different factions going against each other. You know, we try to get a handle on that. We try to do a lot of preventive things to do that. It does happen. It happens more in the city of Chicago. You know, Chicago seems to be making some good strides right now in reducing some of the murders they had compared to what they had from last year and the year before. It's a difficult job to do. But the biggest component is really having the community in a partnership with the community. They're the eyes and ears out there. They know what's going on. You know, there's the code out there, don't talk to the police, don't say anything. Well, that doesn't work. And, you know, the overwhelming majority of people, I don't care what neighborhood you live in, they want a nice neighborhood. They want a safe neighborhood. They want good schools. They want clean streets. They want everything that anybody else wants. So it's difficult sometimes, I think, for people out of fear and retaliation to talk. But community policing has to be a number one component of doing it because you can't arrest your way out of this situation.
We don't have but a little bit of time left here. And I know that there are a lot of community engagement activities that are always planned. Are there any coming up here in the near future we should tell people about?
I don't have the dates, but recently you'll see every year the Night Out Against Crime. Most mm-hmm. communities do that. On the Sheriff's Department, we participate in four or five different communities, maybe even a little bit more. We send officers. We try to do programs. The Sheriff's Department's available anytime to send anybody out to speak in front of a group. We have a number of good officers on the department. They will come out and speak on a number of different topics. They're glad to do that. Anything from our canine unit to people on our detective bureau talk about safety, neighborhood crime watches, things like that. So we're always glad to come out and do that. And we work very well with all our other police agencies and partners out there. We have to. We share information on a daily basis. You know, our detectives can pick up a phone and talk to a police officer in any jurisdiction because they have the contacts and get things going.
We've been talking with Lake County Sheriff's Department Deputy Chief of Police Dan Merchak. He's come in here to talk about the start of the conversation, and we'll continue this conversation, of course, dealing with the crime spillage from Illinois here into Northwest Indiana. Thank you very much for being with us today. I'm glad you stopped by, and we appreciate your comments, and we hope to have you and your colleagues on many more times to talk about the issue and remind people that that helping out is a part of being a good citizen. It's not all on the shoulders of the police or the law enforcement agencies or the courts. The citizens have to help out, too. They have their share in dealing with this. Thanks for helping us today.
Glad to be here, and I wish my colleagues could have been here. But
well, we'll get them in the conversation. They have an opportunity to share the light as well, too, sometime soon. Thanks for being by today. We
Thank
do appreciate
you.
It. It's time to check in with the town of Highland to find out about how projects are moving along for redevelopment and the like in that community. And for that, we are turning to Cecile Pietro, who is the redevelopment director for the town of Highland. Cecile, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Let's take a look first here at the latest on the town theater. The last time we talked, we know that the town council had decided against expanding and upgrading the building itself, expanding it to start in what at least at the time was planned for an arts and entertainment district there along Kennedy Avenue. The idea is not dead, I understand, but it's just going to be, I think, turned over to a private developer, is it not?
Well, at this point in time, Chris, what we're looking at is that whole area between Garfield, Condit, north and south, and along Kennedy Avenue and the walking path on the west. And that whole area is tired and needs some redevelopment now that we're not moving forward with the theater at this time. We would like to redevelop that area. One of the thoughts is to create a mixed use, which would be retail, commercial on the first and second floor, and residential on the third or fourth floor.
Mm-hmm.
That way we encourage people to come and live, work, and play in the downtown and create a sense of place.
It's been there, of course, as just basically a business area along with the town theater for decades, and it's changed over time. Smaller businesses have come and gone, I understand, and I guess there's one business that is there left that's, I guess, making a little delay in actually getting the demolition of that whole area to get going here. Tell us about that business that I guess you're trying to help relocate or helping the owners relocate, I suppose, and what's planned for the demolition work there?
Well, at this time, we own four buildings along Kennedy Avenue. three of them were going to be incorporated within the theater, and then a building south of that, which is 8620 Kennedy Avenue, is a building that has three units in it. We have two tenants in there at this time. One of the tenants is Maria's, and it's a wonderful Mexican restaurant, very fresh food. She does a marvelous job, and we want to keep her in Highland. So we've been actively trying to find a place for her before we can demo all four buildings. We might do them in sequence. We might demo some of them and then later demo another or mm-hmm. two. We've worked that out with Acton Construction, Acton Contracting, which is a demolition firm. And so that may take us some time to complete all of the demolition and make that shovel ready for a developer to come in. So we are working with Maria's. One of the issues we have, which is a good issue to have, is that we are about 95% occupied in our downtown. And we don't have the product to relocate Maria's easily. So we are looking for buildings other than restaurants right now because we just do not have the product in our downtown.
I understand she wants to stay downtown very much so. As she's enjoyed, I guess, being in her spot there where she is right now.
That's correct. She enjoys where she is. So we're trying to replicate that as much as we can in another location. And hopefully we will be able to do that. She has a contract with the town that we assumed when we purchased the building through August of next year, of 2018. So we would like to have that done well before that time. So we are trying to relocate her.
I understand, too, that the Redevelopment Commission is also asking Acton Contracting to do something more than just tearing something down, as their usual case. You want them to try to preserve a very important relic inside the town theater.
Correct. Chris, one of the things that we've been concerned with, we have two projectors that are up in the projection studio upstairs of mm-hmm. the theater, and those are vintage, probably 1946, 47, when the theater was built, and we believe that they actually constructed them up there because we can't figure out any way they could have been taken up there as a whole. So those two projectors we'd like to save if possible, along with we have to remove the other items that are in the theater. We have a few things. We have some sconces on the wall. We have some, I think we still have a couple sculptures that are in there, and we'd like to take those out. Well, Acton's going to help us with the projectors, and our wonderful public works department is going to take some of the smaller items out for us, and we do have the other items we took out earlier, we do have them in storage, and we will put the last few items in storage also. So we are working with Acton on the projectors. That's something we can't move with Public Works. Mm-hmm. They're going to have to probably demo a wall to get those out.
Well, hopefully they can get them out, and I'm sure pretty much intact. That's, I'm sure, the plan. What would the town of Highland like to do with those projectors if they get them out?
Well, nothing has been decided yet. We would like to keep them. They're a historic part of Highland. And we don't know at this time that they are going to be put in storage. That will be decided at a later mm-hmm. date.
Speaking of some other projects in the town of Highland, one thing we've talked about, the Public Works Department, they have a big facility on north edge of the community there on Kennedy Avenue, right there, just before the Highland and Hammondtown line, city line. And I guess there's some plans to do some relocation of Public Works. Tell us what's in the works there.
Well, for many years, Chris, as you may know, one of the items that the Redevelopment Commission has always been concerned about is that north end of Kennedy Avenue. That's prime commercial property. And we believe that it would be a better use for that area to be commercial and retail. The assessed value we could get out of that would be enormous. So we would like to move the Public Works to another location. That's always been our plan. However, since my tenure here, we've looked at that and tried to relocate it to another place. But the EPA came along and said, we do have some issues with sanitary and stormwater, and we would have to build a sanitary tank, and maybe two of them at that north end. When that was under discussion, it became very difficult for us to find a developer who would come in there because of the need for the space of the storage for those tanks, as well as the aesthetics of the area that would change. So that all went on hold. And lately now, we are moving into an agreement now with Hammond to increase their ability to take care of our stormwater and sanitary needs. And once we get that agreement completed, we would like then to, then we won't have to build those sanitary tanks, and then we will be able to relocate the public works. So we are looking at a couple areas in town, and we're hoping that we can negotiate a deal with the owners and then relocate the public works complex.
We're talking basically about garages and office space and the like, I guess, for the crews that that work out of that current facility, I guess, there and do their services all across the community, right?
That's correct. It's both administrative offices for public works as well as all the vehicles and the storage of, you know, salt and sand and other items like that. The park department also has a building up there right now that they use for their vehicles. So all of that would have to be relocated somewhere else in town.
We're talking with Cecile Pietro, who is the Director of Redevelopment for the town of Highland, on some of the projects that the town has coming up and are ongoing as well. I also know, Cecile, that green space, of course, always has been a very important part of the town of Highland. That beautiful billboard that's out there on Indianapolis Boulevard at the north edge of the community is very well thought of as an interesting and very pleasant green space. And I guess that's part of one of the projects, or at least the area is part of the projects that's underway now, is it not?
Yes, and right now they're just in negotiations over that, regarding that area. On the other side of the street, the Redevelopment Commission built that monument sign that just says Highland. It's a beautiful sign.
Yeah.
It's backlit at night. And interestingly, for your listeners, that project was built with the economic development fee that is paid by property owners who receive tax abatement from the town. So when you look at that sign, you'll know that that was not paid by tax dollars, but by property owners who received a tax abatement from the town.
Finally, Cecile, I guess we have to take a look at one other important item that residents in the town of Highland have to come to grips with. That is your retirement from office there at the redevelopment office in Town Hall in Highland. You've been around for quite a while. And what kind of thoughts and recollections do you have about some of the great things you've got to see happen in the town of Highland since you've been the redevelopment director?
Well, Chris, I've been here 12 years, and it's been an amazing ride for me, and I'm going to miss the work. I love redevelopment. It is an opportunity to create vision and a new course for the community, and I have been so blessed with all of the commissions that I've been able to work for. These are people who give of their time freely, and redevelopment commissions have to spend a lot of time planning, thinking over different ways to do things. Their meetings can be 2 to 3 hours long in the past, and when they've done a lot of this planning. So I would like to thank all of those people who I've had the privilege to work with over the years. They are certainly wonderful individuals, and Highland should be very proud of the people that their council appointed to those various redevelopment commissions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we've accomplished a great deal. Sometimes the public isn't totally aware of all what the Redevelopment Commission does. Some of the things are very visible. For example, we've completed 14 facade improvement grants in the downtown, and you know, sometimes people can see that, but they don't realize that we've also brought about 3 TIF areas in the town to create some money to be able to do projects. So with those 14 facades, they've contributed, we have paid 30% of improvements that are made, and that has amounted to about $170,000 on those 14 facades. And over $600,000 has been spent by the property owner just to meet that match. And some have spent way over that to do other aesthetically pleasing improvements. We've also done 8 different tax abatements in town, and that's brought in over $18 million of improvements and 364 jobs. So those kinds of things I think we're very, very proud of, having worked with the Redevelopment Commission. I'm also very proud that we're now 95% occupied in the downtown. Mm-hmm. And we're, as I stated before, we need more product. And that's one hope, that if we create that area around Garfield, Condit, and Kennedy, we can fill that up. We have a need for more retail in the downtown, and I'd like to see something of an entertainment evening venue. And I think that would really spur development in the downtown and other areas within the town.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of things that the town of Highland can continue to do to make improvements, and I hope that at least you're going to hang around and watch some of that happen after you officially step down from your post there with the town.
Well, I do. We'll be around if the town needs me for the transition. You know, and we have several projects now that haven't happened yet, we're still working on. Mm-hmm. And, for example, the project on Main Street, 2209 Main Street, it's called the Cardinal Development. And that could potentially be 116,000 square feet of prime commercial space.
Wow.
Class A office. It's going through right now, was approved by the Plant Commission last week for rezoning. The town council still has to approve it. They still have to go through subdivision. But that could be a wonderful development for the town of Highland. We're very proud of that, moving that one forward. We also are working on a senior housing development near the downtown. And these are very difficult projects because they're redevelopment, Chris, and not just economic development.
Right.
So you have to demolish, you have to assemble properties, and that makes redevelopment much more difficult. So we're very hopeful that those two projects will continue to move along.
That's great. Cecilia Pietro is the soon to retire from her position as the redevelopment director for the town of Highland. We really appreciate the updates and the opportunity to work with you. And I'm glad to hear that you're going to hang around and help out if you've been asked to do so. It was nice to see your touch on these projects and a lot of other people who you have worked with and colleagues, not only at Town Hall, but in other areas as well, too, in the town of Highland, to see these projects get going and to continue on. And thanks for taking time today to talk about the update here. We do appreciate that.
Thank you, Chris. And again, I want to thank everybody that I've had a chance to work with. It's been a pleasure.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. Tomorrow is Thursday, and that means it's Reporters Roundtable. We hope that you'll join us for that here on Regionally Speaking.